Welcome, everyone. This year at Santa Cruz Zen Center, we have a Dharma theme, a topic to explore, which is devotion. Devotion can include many different aspects of practice, and we have a whole year to delve into all of its corners. The dictionary says devotion is a feeling of strong love or loyalty or faithfulness. That's pretty good. Love, loyalty, or faithfulness, which can be expressed to various objects of devotion. And all religions and spiritual practices around the world seem to have various expressions of devotion. I also think of devotion as fully giving oneself, body, speech, and mind, giving or surrendering oneself completely. But devotion almost always seems to imply that there's some object of devotion. Devotion to what, we have to ask, first of all. And though we might explore various objects of devotion, I would propose that within Buddha Dharma, devotion is always devotion to Buddha. And Buddha, the awakened one, has three aspects, three bodies. So I thought to begin this discussion of devotion to Buddha, it might be nice to talk a little bit about what is Buddha in terms of three Buddha bodies, three aspects of Buddha. This is now Mahayana, great vehicle, Buddha Dharma. These three bodies of Buddha don't appear in the early Theravada teachings. So, the first is the Dharma body, Dharma Kaya. Kaya means body, the reality body of Buddha, we might say. The formless, empty vastness itself, the unborn, the deathless, free from all reference points, free from center and edges, free from any graspability of any characteristics, the Dharma body of Buddha. This is where it starts. This is essential Buddha. When one realizes Buddha, this is what one realizes. And we might also call this Buddha nature, or empty awareness itself. And if we're practicing devotion to give oneself fully to an object of devotion at all times, this would be like our highest standard of devotion, we actually would need an object of devotion that's present at all times, that doesn't come and go, and to be fully devoted all the time, we also have to be the subject of devotion would also have to be present all the time and not coming and going. So this kind of ultimate devotion to Buddha, to the Dharmakaya, we could call just sitting our core practice in Zen. It's a total devotional practice. It's giving ourselves completely, body, speech, and mind, to Buddha. It's a our own Buddha nature, this empty vastness of our own ever-present awareness, gives itself to this empty vastness, this ever-present awareness. The Dharmakaya is completely devoted to the Dharmakaya. I would say that's one way of talking about just sitting, or zazen. Maybe that's a kind of unusual way of talking about zazen, or we maybe wouldn't present that in zazen instruction. If a newcomer came in and said, "Oh, how do I sit meditation?" We said, "Well, just let the Dharmakaya give itself to the Dharmakaya." But it seems that if we're really opening to present vastness in zazen, that's actually what's happening. I think it's a description. There might even be other stuff going on. There might even be thoughts going on of getting distracted by past and future thoughts. But meanwhile, behind that, the Dharmakaya of our own nature is giving itself to the Dharmakaya nature of all Buddhas. In this realm of Dharmakaya, there's no separation between ourself and others. So it's not like me being devoted to some other Buddha. There's no separation. There's not many Buddhas in this realm. It's beyond many and one. Those are just more conceptual categories. So to give oneself, to be totally devoted at all times, this is maybe the only way, is the way that the Dharmakaya is always devoted to the Dharmakaya of Buddha. So our primary devotional practice is zazen, letting go of everything, opening to the ever-present, unhindered vastness. As a metaphor, sometimes the Dharmakaya is compared to space. And in the tradition, when the Buddha bodies are presented in the ancient sutras, it's said that only Buddhas can directly perceive the Dharmakaya itself. Even Bodhisattvas, not to mention ordinary beings, can't directly perceive the Dharmakaya, even though it's ever-present with us all the time. So there's a way in which our own vastness of mind is devoted to the vastness of the mind of all Buddhas. And then we have the second Buddha body is called the Sambhogakaya. If Dharmakaya is the reality body, Sambhogakaya is literally the bliss body of Buddha. And it's the clear light, luminous clarity aspect of awareness itself. If Dharmakaya is emphasizing the boundless vastness of it, the emptiness of all graspable characteristics, the Sambhogakaya is like the knowing, clear aspect of mind, of all of our minds. We all have the nature of our own mind already is fully complete with these three Buddha bodies. It's just that they're also obscured by our usual karmic tendencies. So the Sambhogakaya, bliss body of Buddha, is the clarity aspect, the knowing aspect, the radiant light aspect. And if Dharmakaya is like space, Sambhogakaya is like sunlight filling the space. I think it's a really nice metaphor, image for this. There's just empty space, maybe dark, empty space, but then when we're attending to the Sambhogakaya aspect, it's radiantly bright, like a clear summer sky. Still just as empty and vast, but bright and clear, knowing space now. Now it's a knowing kind of space. And this clarity like manifests as various qualities like wisdom and compassion and love, and that's why there's all these archetypal Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. Like on our altar here, Manjushri is the archetypal Bodhisattva of perfect wisdom. So it's like when vast empty space is conjoined with this knowing quality, and the knowing is like penetrates all directions with this perfect wisdom that sees clearly how everything actually is. That's, we call that manifestation, Manjushri, Bodhisattva. And on the back of the altar is Avalokiteshvara, Bodhisattva. It's the same empty, vast space, the same clear knowing, but the knowing in this case manifests, emphasizing the compassionate, loving, open quality of empty awareness. So, because all these bodhisattvas include all these beneficent qualities, but they particularly shine in one or the other, they manifest differently. They have different forms. Manjushri rides on a lion and sometimes carries a sword. One of those marks manifesting from empty space to cut through delusion. Whereas Avalokiteshvara has this vase of ambrosia, healing waters to soothe the pain of all beings. She has different implements. So they come in these different forms. I say archetypal because they're not really like historical people. They're the way Buddha manifests these different types of qualities. And again, traditionally in the sutras, they say only Buddhas can directly perceive the Dharmakaya. Only the Bodhisattvas on the last stages before Buddhahood, it is said, can directly perceive the Sambhogakaya. So that's why we don't usually see Manjushri and Avalokiteshvara walking down the street in that particular form with all their jewelry and sword waving through the air. I mean, some of you might, but I haven't come across them like that. But the tradition says that these great bodhisattvas of the past have seen them directly, and that's why they're these kind of universal forms. And within Buddha Dharma, they get depicted sometimes slightly differently, but there's some agreement on what implements they carry and how they look, because they actually do have a form, but it's a light body. And then that light body gets made into these paintings and statues for us to relate to. This is what this Sambhogakaya looks like. So we can relate to it. We can relate to those qualities. So there's an ancient tradition of iconography in Buddha Dharma. One story is that in the earliest tradition, there wasn't any. There weren't any statues or paintings. Occasionally, Buddha would just be depicted as footprints, like where he left his mark. But I think it was kind of like a Dharmakaya emphasis in the early Buddhism, and that's why they didn't want to have some form to limit the Dharmakaya. But after just a couple centuries, pretty soon, there were these statues and paintings and forms. And I think that's because, I think part of it is the practical thing of we have a particular visual form. We carry implements, stuff. So we like to relate to other beings like us in that way. We're relational beings, and it's hard to relate to the Dharmakaya. In fact, strictly speaking, I would say it's impossible to relate to the Dharmakaya because we actually just are the Dharmakaya. It's not an object to relate to. And strictly speaking, all three of these Buddha bodies are not exactly objects to relate to. But when we depict Sambhogakaya light bodies in these images, Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and Dharma protectors and so on, then they become relatable. But it's good to remember that they're expressions of Buddha, of awakened, totally wise and compassionate mind and heart with these different qualities. So if we want to relate to our own compassionate quality of our own Buddha nature, then we might like make offerings to Avalokiteshvara. I feel like my wisdom is really sharp these days, but my compassionate heart is not so alive. Make offerings to Avalokiteshvara. But on the other hand, I might feel like my compassionate heart's really alive, but I feel really dull, and I don't get any of this stuff about emptiness. Then we make offerings to Manjushri instead. So they're for us to relate to in these ways, our own Buddha qualities depicted in these ways. And that's often how we do relate to Sambhogakaya, traditionally, is making offerings. So if our Dharmakaya devotion is Zazen, which we start the day with Zazen, then when we've done some Dharmakaya devotion, then we can get up and do this Sambhogakaya devotion, relating to these light bodies with particular qualities. Through offering incense, light, flowers, water, sometimes food, and chanting, and taking refuge in them, and repenting before them, and making prostrations, lowering our body before them. I say them, but really it's like our universal nature of perfect wisdom, perfect compassion. I think if we say it's that great Buddha somewhere out there that we're bowing to, that's a little off. But if we say I'm just bowing to my own personal Buddha nature and my own compassion, I think that's a little off too. It just tends to get too self-centered. Really, these qualities of Buddha are not possessed by Buddhas out there as opposed to me, and they're not possessed by me as opposed to Buddhas out there. In the realm of these great Buddha qualities, there is no separation between self and other. They're not possessed by anyone. They're universal, ever-available qualities that we as sentient beings can tap into. Buddha can manifest, come through us in these particular ways, and these devotional practices can invoke those Buddhas through our body and mind, if that makes sense. It's one way, I think, of looking at devotion, particularly our rituals and ceremonies where we have Buddha and Bodhisattva figures. The Sambhogakaya. So then, the third Buddha body is called Nirmanakaya, the transformation body or manifestation body of Buddha. Like actual physical forms, if only Buddhas can directly perceive the Dharmakaya and only these last stage Bodhisattvas can directly perceive the Sambhogakaya, all beings can perceive Nirmanakaya. That's what's so nice about them, Nirmanakayas. They make themselves out of compassion. They make themselves available and perceptible out of compassion. It's like they don't need to. or we could say Buddha mind doesn't need to manifest in any particular physical form, but it does out of compassion to benefit us. So we have like the supreme Nirmanakaya is like Shakyamuni Buddha, the founder of so-called Buddhism in India 2500 years ago, who looked like an ordinary person who had an ordinary lifespan of 80 years and walked around India. At least that's how it appears. Buddha made himself visible in this way to benefit many, many beings all the way down to us. So if the Dharmakaya is like empty space and the Sambhogakaya is like sunlight filling that space, Nirmanakaya traditionally is sometimes said to be like that light mixing with other elements and forming like rainbows in the air. I think that works quite nicely too. So that, 'cause just light filling space is still just like basically space. It's just radiant, bright space now. But it takes particular form when it comes through raindrops and mist in the air as rainbow in a particular location. And it has color and shape. And maybe the reason that metaphor is sometimes used is because even the Nirmanakaya is not really some physical, solid, tangible, chunky thing. Strictly speaking, Shakyamuni Buddha was not like solid, made of solid matter. His body was not made of solid matter. Just like our bodies, strictly speaking, are not made of solid matter. They're a little bit more like rainbows, if we look closely. But we could also say any. Now the light is reflected off of everything and manifesting as everything. So particularly when the Buddha qualities manifest as great teachers, as maybe the actual now statues on the altar could be seen as like physical Nirmanakaya forms, the ones that we would call wood and clay. Even in the old sutras it said Nirmanakaya Buddha can manifest not just as humans, not just as animals, but even as bridges and boats, for example, can be not supreme Nirmanakaya Buddha like Shakyamuni, but all these Nirmanakaya manifestations to benefit beings. A bridge helps people cross over a treacherous river. So a bridge, Buddha can manifest as a bridge to help people. That's quite awesome. So therefore, we might be meeting Nirmanakaya Buddhas like all day long in many, many forms. You say, if they're helping us, if they're teaching us Dharma, if they're opening us to a wider view, if they're opening us to a bigger heart of compassion, then those are like little Dharmakaya meetings. I mean, Nirmanakaya meetings. Really coming from the Dharmakaya, you could say, is the source. It manifests as the Sambhogakaya, and then this also manifests in an even more tangible way as the Nirmanakaya. So if devotion to the Dharmakaya is just sitting, dropping off body and mind, and devotion to the Sambhogakaya is our formal Zen ceremonies and rituals of making offerings to Buddha qualities, then devotion to Nirmanakaya Buddha could be bowing to actual living teachers. It could be taking care of the practice place, sweeping the temple after we've done the Dharmakaya devotion and the Sambhogakaya devotion in the morning. We can do this Nirmanakaya devotion where we take care of the temple. Why? Because the temple could be Not necessarily, but it could be for us a Buddha helping open us to the vastness. Just the very space of sacred space of a building like this could be teaching us something. So in that way, Buddha could be manifesting as a Zen sitting hall, and then our devotion to it could be just sweeping it and cleaning the cushions. I think so. As devotion to Nirmanakaya and taking care of the Sangha community when people are sick and so on, serving others like this. I think if we see it as we're just helping them, that's a good practice. But I think as devotion to Nirmanakaya, I think it's when we see that the sick person is waking us up to our bigger heart. At that time, they're like a manifestation of Nirmanakaya Buddha. They might not even know it. Buddhas do not necessarily notice that they are Buddhas. But Buddha could be coming into this sick person who doesn't appreciate being sick, but they're actually Buddhas coming into this sick person to help us, maybe, the caretaker, open to them. I'm open to it, things working in this way, in this big universe. So also, the Bodhisattva precepts is a big part of devotional practice, taking care of how we live in the world with each other in a harmless way. And we could look at that as a kind of Nirmanakaya, physical embodiment, body, speech, and mind, devotional practice. When we meet others, trying not to kill them, to steal from them, to misuse sex through them, to lie to them, to intoxicate them, and so on. So that's a devotional practice to manifestations. We might say, if our perception is really pure, that everything could be a manifestation of Buddha. It's not so much that it depends on some particular Buddha intention to come into a rock or a bridge and make this Nirmanakaya. I think it's much more interactive. Depends on the recipient and the whole dance of meeting, dependently arising together, that makes any given experience be a Buddha experience or not. So that's a little introduction I throw out tonight as for our year of devotion, as devotion to Buddha. Everything in our practice that could be seen as devotion could be seen as devotion to Buddha and these three Buddha bodies. So, any questions or comments how we might actually practice with that? Yes, Charlie.
So could you talk a little more about how the Dharmakaya is related to Zazen?
Yeah. Dharmakaya, devotion as Zazen. So if Dharmakaya is just the boundless space of Buddha, that aspect. Also, I would put in parentheses here, it's traditionally said that these three Buddha bodies can't really ever be separated. You can't really have a Dharmakaya without the other two form bodies. But you can emphasize, you can attend to certain aspects. You can attend to one of the three bodies that go together. So with the Dharmakaya as the vast, empty aspect of mind, it's not the whole story of our mind. But in Zazen, I would say that is the aspect of Buddha nature that we're attending to. So in Zazen, we usually say, sit down in an upright posture, so we're steady and balanced, and come into the present, where we already always are living, but we often forget. Rest in the present. And we all know this is much easier said than done. But as we rest more and more fully in the present, we have the potential to access the Dharmakaya. The Dharmakaya is also accessible in when thinking about the past and future, but it just seems that when we are thinking about the past and future, that's one of the main obscurations to the Dharmakaya. By nature, they don't obscure it. It's just that it seems, practically speaking, that's how it works. Because the past and the future are not where the Dharmakaya lives. Dharmakaya is always right here. So, in the present, we're relaxed and settled, open, and breathing in a relaxed, open way, and then we can just look at the vastness, directly look at the vastness. And in a way, it's hard to say much more about that. If we start describing it a lot, then we start to attend to the not so vast conceptual qualities. So, but like vast space is a nice metaphor. If we feel kind of constricted, we can even imagine actually vast empty space, and let the mind of the present open into the vast empty space that is all around always. The mind has no edges or boundaries like space, so we let it extend outwardly, not finding any boundaries. And now we're starting to open to the Dharmakaya aspect in Zazen. We can also attend to like the Sambhogakaya quality in Zazen, the clear knowing. If we start to feel like almost spacing out in the vast openness, we can refresh the kind of clear, sharp, aware, awake quality. We'll be kind of, I would say, attending to Sambhogakaya quality in Zazen. These really are qualities of our own mind, of everybody's mind. It's not like they need to be developed. They're just need to be attended to. Dharmakaya, Zazen, devotion to Dharmakaya as Zazen, particularly if we're feeling narrow or constricted, feeling into the spaciousness. Yes?
I think I understand what you're saying, but it still seems like for me, like, devotion is extra. You know, like if I'm sitting in Zazen or if I'm practicing, if I'm doing service, I'm doing service. If I'm helping others, I'm helping others. And now devotion is an extra thing. And I'm not sure where that's helpful for me.
It could sound like an extra thing, but if we say devotion is giving oneself completely, it's kind of the definition, right? So sometimes we can be doing all three of these types of Buddha body devotions not completely, right? I mean, I know I can be sitting Zazen and like, well, let me just run through this list of what I have to do today one more time, and then I'll get down to Dharmakaya Zazen. And I could say, I'm not really giving myself to the vastness here. So there is a kind of quality of how can I turn up the devotion in my Zazen? I think there is we can add it. It does seem like adding in an intention, we might say. It's an intention to bring more devotion, which simply means, in the case of Zazen, bring more wholehearted giving.
Well, I would try to draw my thinking, or I would try to follow my breath. I would say, well, I need to devote more to this practice of Zazen, whatever I say. You know what I'm saying? I would just focus on my breath, or I would try to just, you know, I don't know what I do to try to drop my thoughts, but, you know, I just hold my breath, or I don't...
That could be a way to do, yeah, that could be a way to...
I mean, call it devotion, but I wouldn't go, oh, I need to devote myself to Zazen.
You don't need to use that language, yeah. That's why I'm kind of presenting this idea of devotion as really all-inclusive.
Yeah.
Just, we could even call it wholeheartedness. And yeah, if you don't like the word, it doesn't need to be used, right? But also, I think devotion has a kind of heart quality to it. So it could be like, I am making wholehearted effort, just like, get out of my way, wholehearted effort. Could be like a very kind of mind-oriented wholeheartedness. But devotion is more heart quality. It might be like, I really want to. I have some sense of this vast Buddha being here right now, just like waiting for me to open to it. And I'm not right now. So like, how can I open the heart of devotion? It could be a heart quality. That's just for Zazen. I think for service is an interesting one for me, because I confess that it's very easy doing this, our ritual services 2 times every day like this, to do them in a very just mechanical, rote way. I imagine it is for others too, sometimes, that we can go through the motions. We can also do them really mindfully, but try to be really present. But to have that heart quality is, I think, something we actually... I would like to, particularly this year of devotion, try to access this heart quality of devotion during service. Because I think that's what they originally came from, is a kind of very heartfelt devotional quality. And, you know, a Japanese Zen ritual is maybe amongst the world religions, amongst the drier kind of forms. It's maybe one of the only monotone forms of singing, devotional singing in the world of religion, which I think has good functions too. For that, it's about deep energy from the hara, you know. But how to bring a kind of heart emotional quality to that too? And for me, I think it may be helpful to remember this Sambhogakaya light qualities of these actual compassion and wisdom, actually tangible compassion and wisdom pervading all of our hearts in the room at any moment, that we're invoking them when we chant the Dahi Shindarani or the Enmei Juku Kanagyo. We're really invoking the heart of Avalokiteshvara. Sometimes I try to do that, but often I forget. So that's a kind of Sambhogakaya devotional practice. We could say, well, that seems extra. Why not just be mindful and present? And I think that's a good practice too, but I think it's possible to bring the heart quality in also. Yes, Richard.
Like Ken, I have a bit of a flinching reaction to devotion, but I, when I think of it, I think of it as a way of moving away from self-identity, you know, to a way of really giving over. I mean, in a guru sense, it's effectively repugnant to some people, but, or in any sense, you know, if you really are devoted, you're giving yourself up.
Yes, I think I didn't even mention that, but I think that's a key aspect. You could even say the function. What's the purpose of devotion in Buddhism? How does it fit into the system? It's exactly that. Buddhism is the antidote to self. Devotion is the antidote to self-cherishing, and so it's like melting the self-centered heart. One of my teachers has talked about devotion in that way. So it's a heart quality, and towards Zazen even. I think we can bring in this heart, emotional heart quality in Zazen, which we usually don't talk about it that way, I admit. But I think that especially if we're doing it a lot, it can be Zazen can become a dry mechanical thing. Just concentrate. How many numbers am I up to? That's not what Zazen's about, right? We're like, it's about something really vast and juicy and joyful and loving. I think we're tapping in, we can potentially tap into in Zazen. And service too. If we're going to do it two times a day, let's not just go through the motions, right? What's the point of that? So then, can we melt a kind of self-cherishing heart, give up the self? And I think in ritual is good for this in many ways, particularly in any tradition, because there's a particular way to do a ritual, right? That we inherit from a tradition. It's nice. Then we can, then, because all of us then have some probably complaint about it. We don't probably like everything about our rituals, which is very nice. If we loved them completely, then we wouldn't get this chance to practice giving up ourself. And like, I wish we could just sing it once instead of monotone. And, can I just give my heart totally my preference of this and just wholeheartedly sing it in monotone in this, way that gives up my idea about it. I think that's one nice benefit of group ritual and tradition, basically. If we make it all up ourselves, well, let's make it more fun. I think there's room for that too. We can do some ceremonies. We can change them around and make them more musical. We can experiment. But there's something nice about an ancient way where we're devoted to the ancestors that pass it to us, like that.
Well, a word is sarcastic.
Yes.
Oh, if you're still talking, go ahead.
Well, just on that, just from a musical point of view, I mean, it's easy to forget the power of a single note, a drone, is nothing. Nothing is deeper musically or more penetrating than one note.
Mm.
One note. I mean, and if you do nothing really I can expound on, you know, like I could, but I'm not going to, but that's a, it's just like a knife cut. It's just a deep, rich, powerful thing, drone.
Yeah.
There's nothing missing when you're, just because you don't have some harmonies going on.
Yeah, there's never anything missing. Yes.
Just a couple things. One is if you're tired of the monotone, there's always the chanting of the refuges in Pali.
Yeah.
To give us an opportunity in our Zen devotion to vary the tonality. And I'm thinking in terms of devotion, the feeling in Sesshin after sitting all day silently in our own environment, and when we all stand up and we join for the closing refuge and we sing those refuges. That to me is like the what I love about devotional practice is that it's a way that brings us together.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have both. We have this, you know, complete, you know, solitary really meeting of
Dharmakaya
through our own Nirmanakaya, Sambhogakaya. And then we have this communal expression that we do.
Yeah.
And I think that is one of the functions of the devotional practices, is to connect us with each other.
Mm-hmm. The form bodies. Sometimes Sambhogakaya and Nirmanakaya together are called the form bodies. And they are, they're the relatable bodies. They're how we meet others and join together in Sangha and devotion. Yeah. So it's good we have both.
I think it's good.
And it's true, we do have occasional melodies, like the refuges and the full moon ceremony. It's quite a bit of melody, Yeah. Well, let's keep looking at this devotion. And maybe there's something to be devoted to besides Buddha, but I can't think of anything. uh, I'll just end with a story here. Maybe more about this, about ritual devotion. This is one of our Zen ancestors, Dongshan, in ancient China. And in his early years, he set out to visit different teachers and first went to visit Nan Chuan. And he arrived when they were setting up the offerings of rice and tea for Nan Chuan's teacher's memorial service, Matsu's memorial service, like we do here, monthly memorials for the founding teachers. We make offerings to the... What body is that we make offerings to? As a little aside, I think this is just Japanese Zen tradition. It says those little tablets in the back of the altar with the names on them. Those are kind of like represent the deceased ancestors. And Zen tradition says that of the three bodies, those are Dharmakaya. You might think, well, those are like a physical, like wooden thing, right? I think because they don't look like a, like we have these photos that you could say the photos like a Nirmanakaya portrait of the teacher, but this formless drop of, with the writing on it is actually the Dharma body of the teacher. And you make offerings to the Dharma body actually there. Interestingly, anyway, they had probably had these wooden tablets, and they probably had portraits too. And Nan Chuan, the teacher, who, as they were setting up for this offering ceremony, said to the assembly, "Tomorrow we will pay homage and make these offerings to Matsu. Do you think he will come here, return here, or not? Will he make the offerings?" And no one offered any reply. So Dongshan came forward and said, "He will come if he has a companion present." So we might say, the Sambhogakaya qualities of Manjushri and Avalokiteshvara and the Buddha and the ancestral teachers, they will actually come if there's a companion present. They're not like just waiting there somehow for us. They manifest in response to beings. That's how these form bodies work. That's how Buddha works. So he will come as soon as he has a present companion. Nan Chuan said, "This fellow, though young, is suitable for being cut and polished." And young Dongshan said, "Teacher, don't crush what is good into something mean." So he's saying, this young student is pretty sharp, saying something like that. And the young Dongshan says, "Don't crush something that's already complete into this something that needs cutting and polishing. That's too coarse." If we've been practicing for a while and we feel like it's kind of dry and we're going through the motions, but we can't quite remember why. I think we all go through these phases some. Devotion is like the cure. I'd say, but how could I? I don't have any devotion. That's why I feel this way. Well, what can we do? Maybe we actually enact something. The nice thing about the ritual things is it's engaging body and speech. I say, well, let me just think about devotion until it arises. No, I don't really feel it, but let's do it anyway. Let's just offer the incense anyway. And then sometimes in the act of offering, the devotion arises miraculously. May May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable.